My name is Joel Lessies, and I am the founder, host, and producer of Unraveling Religion. I want to introduce you to a very special episode. This is an introduction to Unraveling Religion's inaugural episode with Major Reagan, which was recorded November 14th, 2007. Unraveling Religion was born. Mage and I had a conversation with the theme, "What's it all for?" And Mage goes on to explore the many facets of poetry and spirituality, existentialism, smatterings of religion, and his own experiences in this very special talk. I hope you enjoy it.
It's a pleasure to be with you. I have a habit of sometimes waking my wife at night and shaking her shoulder and saying, "What's it all for? Let's talk about it." And not what it all means, but what it's for, our lives. What Randall Jarrell, the poet, called the dailiness of life, the way the days add up into years. What's it for? And I turn to all kinds of things that are around us, all kinds of teachings and traditions, and they have much to say about it. And when I was thinking about it today, I turned to some notes that I'd taken in an old copy of the I Ching, the Book of Changes, that I've had for, I guess, 30 some years, and came across the notion of the Native Americans, the Plains Indians, the Sundance religion that believes that each person is a unique living medicine wheel, a living fire of power and color, powerful beyond imagination, that has been limited and placed upon this earth to touch, experience, and learn. And so every man and woman and child at one time was a living power that existed somewhere in time and space, but we were powers without form, but we were aware, and we were alive, and we were perfect, and we were beautiful in all ways except one. And we had no understanding of limitation. We had no experience of limitation, and were incomplete in that sense. And the beings that we were and are were total energy of the mind, but we had no body or heart. And so that one answer to the question, what is it all for, is that we were placed upon this earth that we might learn these things of the heart through touching. And there's only one thing that all people possess equally, and the Sundancer religion believed that it is our loneliness. No two people on the face of the earth are alike in any one thing except for their loneliness. And it is the cause of our growing, but it's also the cause of our wars. Love and hate and greed and generosity are all rooted in our loneliness, within our desire to be needed and loved. And the only way that we can overcome our loneliness is through touching.
It seems like it's the longing, right? It's a longing that we all share.
Yeah, it is that. And I don't think we understand our longings and the power that they have to move us towards some kind of growth, toward evolution, that there are all kinds of things that thwart that growth. And I think that's one of the reasons that people turn to some kind of teaching tradition, whatever it be, because there is a path, and others have traveled that path and have left the trail marked so that we know the way. But this is one that that comes to mind, that the way we overcome it is through touching. And there's another that idea of touching and allowing the world to touch us deeply. There's a little passage from a terrific book that I think many people know from, by Jack Kornfield, called A Path with Heart. And he says, when we let ourselves feel the fear, the discontent, the difficulties we have always avoided, our heart softens. just as it is a courageous act to face all the difficulties from which we've always run, it is also an act of compassion. According to Buddhist scriptures, compassion is the quivering of the pure heart when we have allowed ourselves to be touched by the pain of life. And as we allow the world to touch us deeply, we recognize that just as there is pain in our lives, there is pain in everyone else's life, and this becomes the birth of wise understanding. And if we follow the notion, the Christian notion of the garden and the expulsion from that paradise, then once we've eaten of the fruit of the knowledge, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, then we're driven out, and we're driven into knowing, and we just go deeper into knowing. And I don't know there is another way. How can we unknow? And I suppose anyone's birth into this world is an initial awakening and the beginning of the work. And the deeper imperative is to awaken to the inner life, the life that's inside of us, the bodhisattva, which literally means bodhi, awakened, and sattva, being. So we awaken. It's a series of awakenings. That's what a life is. The Greeks have there's a word that I've been thinking about for years, and I keep turning to it when I think about what it's all for and how that's involved with knowing more deeply and knowing finally as a kind of liberation. The Greek word is anagnorisis, and I first came across it when I was studying Sophocles' great tragedy, Oedipus Rex, Oedipus the King, and apparently it's also in Aristotle's Poetics, the notion that the audience, when they witness the tragedy, is aroused to pity and fear, and then there is that purgation of pity and fear. And when the protagonist, Oedipus, discovers the awful truth, which he himself sought. But apparently what the Greeks understood was that this word, anagnorisis, is the highest happiness, because it is the truth seen as plainly and as barely as possible, without evasion, so that the very truth itself is beautiful, even though it is born of tragedy. And hence, you know, John Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn, the inscription that beauty is truth and truth beauty, and that is all you ever shall know or ever need to know. And so that even seeing the terrible things plainly, the Greeks identified with a very high kind of completion and happiness, not a gratification, kind of happiness, and a kind of a moment when the string is plucked and the note is pure, and we hear the truth and know the truth, and they valued that greatly. So maybe that's one of the things it's all for, to come to that moment.
I was just wondering, through poems, like, if you had anything that you'd like to share.
Yeah, I guess I do. The poetry is the way I try to think about the self and think about the world. Well, it's a kind of conversation with the soul, I guess, too. Not only I've been reading a book by Robert Bly called News of the Universe, and you know, Bly argues adamantly that that the soul is not in us, but it's out in the world. And in order to discover our soul, we have to go away from ourselves and out into the world. And so the poetry becomes a kind of conversation with the world, a conversation with not the not the little self, but the big self that's out out beyond beyond the skin. Here's a poem called "The Body is a Cognitive Map." It's and it's prefaced by a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, who has been a great teacher to me, has joined the Christian and Buddhist traditions in a wonderful way. It's very practical and very clear. He has a great gift of clarity, and the body is a cognitive map. And the quote from Thich Nhat Hanh is that the enlightenment of the wave is to understand that it is water. My understanding of that, those two lines, is that if we believe we are, our essential nature is wave, then we are destroyed when we strike the shore, that the identity we have is lost. But if we remember that we are, first of all, water, and that is the ground of our being, then nothing has changed, only the shape, but not the essential nature, and we're liberated from fear of any kind of loss, because we are secure in the ground of our being, as the wave must understand that it is water. So this poem, Dr. Verdina, every time the pneumonia returns and a little more of me wears away against the stone, the brighter my soul flares, its carnival lights strung across the bony mast of my shoulders. The body is a temporary shelter, not my real home. I don't want to become too accustomed to things down here below. The quick text of skin, the scarlet banner of appetite, the consolations of children, work, and dreams. Conditions come together to give shape to the wave, to the body. When these conditions change, the form is altered. This morning, all around me, sea shines, the sky opens into ocean. I am turning away from shore toward water. And when I wrote that, I was in Provincetown, Cape Cod, out on the very tip of the Cape, and was literally surrounded by water. The land is only a couple of miles across there at the tip, and everything was shining, and the water to me suggested the kind of limitlessness in which we live. The limitlessness is not somewhere we go, but it's somewhere we are. And I was turning away from shore, that is, being bound to it, toward something which was boundless, and a kind of liberation, with an understanding that the body is a temporary shelter, and that my real home is elsewhere. I am here only because certain conditions came together, and when they change, what the Buddhists call the five aggregates, then that temporary shelter is abandoned. Well, I think that I'm essentially a storyteller. You know, most of what I write is narrative, and I began to, I'm from southeastern Illinois, a farm country, and I think I began by listening to the stories of the elders, men and women who, without knowing it, perhaps told the stories of their lives. There's something in us that wants to articulate who we are and what we're doing, and we are storytelling creatures, and I think I very early picked that up, and I became a kind of listener, and I think the listening is crucial for any kind of writer. I believe that writing is mostly receptivity. You know, sure, it's the work of putting it down on the page, but the key to beginning is receptivity. Being a deep listener, listening with the cheekbones and the palms of the hands to what others say, speaking the language that we share. So it began there with me, and then I began to read some poems, and you know, poems always seem to be a part of the deep and enduring record of what it's meant to be human on this planet, the history of our humanness. But I didn't write any poems really until I was about 35 years old. I ripened very slowly. I know some wonderful poets who are way beyond what I do, or 19 and 20 years old. I don't know how to account for that, except that we ripen it at different rates and at different times. And
yeah.
I think it is a long kind of process of evolution and ripening. And then I began to read a lot. I read James Wright. I read Robert Bly. I stumbled on to the wonderful Chinese poets of the Dang Dynasty, the 8th and 9th century A.D., Li Bo, Tu Fu, Bo Qi, Wang Wei. Those poets seemed friends of mine, and still seem so to this day, even though they are dust. And that's one of the real peculiar truths of poetry, or anything written down. One of the great boons, the great gifts of language, is that that nothing is really lost. I mean, they are gone, but their poems remain, and I can read them. I could go find them, and somehow I am present with them. And so I read the Chinese poets, and I read the Beat poets, and the exuberance in them was very important to me, and the freedom with which they wrote. And then I discovered Rumi and Kabir, Mirabai, and poets of other cultures. And I think that one of the things that occurs during a life is that the circle of awareness widens and deepens. And that's one of the great pleasures of staying in the world for a long time, to be aware of that. And Allen Ginsberg points out somewhere that awareness surrounds thought, and thought and awareness are not the same thing. And but when awareness surrounds thought, then you're in some deep place, some deep kind of knowing. That was kind of the route I took, or the path I followed.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, Mage, about the power of the spoken word, maybe like the jawbone that you have there in Northeast Ohio.
Well, I think poetry probably, I really began to write poetry when I first began to listen to it. That about 1975, I would have been 35 years old, and I came back from Illinois to Kent to read my poetry for the first time, and along with about six or seven other people, and at a gallery. And I'd never really heard poets read their own work before. I'd heard recordings, that kind of thing, but famous poets, but that seemed kind of far away. But when I heard people read for the first time and struggle with all of the doubt and difficulty, and yet bring the words off the page with their breath, you know, I began to see it in a way that had a lot more dimensions to it. And I've been to hundreds of poetry readings over the last few decades, and I love to listen as well as read. In fact, I enjoy listening more than reading my own work. I enjoy listening to others, and it seems to me that the Spanish philosopher Ortega said that truth is the sum of all perspectives, and it seems to me that each poem is a perspective, and if you add all of those up, then you get something near the the whole truth, and there's some kind of magical act involved in lifting the ghost script of these little markings on a page up with the breath. And Gary Snyder says that there are three mysteries, three great mysteries, and they are the body and the voice and the mind. Mahayana Buddhism, Great Vehicle Buddhism, talks about the three mysteries, body, voice, and mind, and the things that are what living is for us in life. And poetry is the vehicle of the mystery of the voice. And the universe, you know, is sometimes spoken of as one vast breathing body. So anytime you get up in a room with people and you read your poem and your breath lifts up the words, they are forever lifted. They don't go back down. They continue to go outward, and they become somehow part of the vast breathing body, which is the universe in which we lived. I mean, it's a very particular thing.
In the early 90s, there was a cafe in Kent called The Brady, and we had a lot of readings there, poetry readings, and every time I had to write a paper, I'd go to The Brady, and it would just sort of stream out, and it was not that way in any other place. It was just at The Brady.
Yeah, I think that energy is present and doesn't go away, and I think that we had poetry readings there for 20 years before we moved on now to a little gallery down on the Water Street in here in Kent. But the Brady readings were terrific. There were sometimes 50 readers, and I think that probably those words, it's no longer the Brady, but it's been taken over as a Starbucks, but I assume that somehow way up and around the ceiling those words still buzz around like bees, you know. Nothing goes away. Nothing that's real goes away. I think, where we can't find it.
Yeah.
Wallace Stevens had that idea. So that, it's a kind of investment and in a place. And when you do that, it's like working a garden. You know, you invest in a garden. You fertilize it. You compost it. You plant it. You harvest it. You take care of it. And I think that when people gather at a poetry reading, it's something like gardening, you know, with words and with breath, and it is shared work. And Gary Snyder has a wonderful phrase for it. He says that we are all fellow workers in the Buddha fields. It's shared work, you know. You know, one of the one idea that that runs through many, many teaching traditions, many contemplative spiritual traditions, is the notion of inherent goodness. It's in Chöng Trungpa's Kagyu Tibetan teaching. He taught at Naropa in Boulder, and the Shambhala teachings insist that there is an inherent goodness in each of us, and that's where we begin with that. And Buddhism recognizes also an essential goodness that is part of our nature, deeply so, and we have to find that and to believe it and to address the goodness in one another. I came across a couple of years ago, an anonymous saying that man is an arrow unto himself turned inward. And it speaks to what's destructive in our nature, that we would be an arrow unto ourselves turned inward. And I'm thinking that perhaps the work of a life is to turn that arrow outward toward the world and direct it not at persons but an open field or a calm lake or a sleeping mountain. Find a way to turn the arrow around and to preserve one's essential goodness and to communicate with other people at that level. And I think of that old truth, first, do no harm to oneself and to others as a fundamental way to live a life. First, do no harm. And I also think of the Dalai Lama's words that kindness is his religion, and simple as that. And it's very difficult to make kindness one's religion because you're challenged every day. It's easy to be kind to one's friends, but it's more difficult to be kind to those who are unkind to you, or who have decided that they are your enemies. And in Sanskrit, it is ahimsa, that is to do no harm. And I've been reading a book by William Stafford on peace and war called Every War Has Two Losers, and he speaks to that question of inherent goodness, and his poem is called For the Unknown Enemy, and I think it has a great relevance for Americans now. This monument is for the unknown good in our enemies. Like a picture, their life began to appear. They gathered at home in the evening and sang. Above their fields, they saw a new sky. Holidays came, and they carried the baby to the park for a party. Sunlight surrounded them. Here we glimpse what their minds long turned away from. The great mutual blindness darkened that sunlight in the park, and the sky that was new, and the holidays. This monument says that one afternoon, we stood here, letting a part of our minds escape. They came back, a different enemy. One day we glimpsed your life. This monument is for you. And so William Stafford, as a pacifist, he was a conscientious objector in World War II. He died in 1993. Insisted all of his life that he was a pacifist and would do no harm. And he argued that it is essential that we find the unknown goodness in one's enemies. And I think it's an idea to
embrace. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about Buddhism's practicality, the practical aspect of Buddhism.
It's much easier to talk about poetry than it is about Buddhism for me, because it's all it's so mixed. And my initial discovery of Buddhism, I was raised in a Methodist, Lutheran, Christian Science home, and I my allegiances were very mixed, and I came across Paul Repp's little collection of Zen Buddhism writings called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, and I'm sure many people have discovered it, but it was the beginning of something for me. I didn't feel at home in any of the other religions that my parents visited, but I felt at home immediately in that tradition out of which Zen Flesh, Zen Bones came. And then I read D.T. Suzuki's writing about Buddhism. This would be in the late 50s and early 60s, and there wasn't a great deal around then, but it was enough to understand that here was a spiritual context in which I could live my life. And it was also evident very early that this was an unbroken 2,500-year-old teaching tradition. And I embraced it immediately. Buddhism is wonderfully judgmental, and I learned from Zen Buddhism a distinction. I think this is in Roshi Suzuki's book, Beginner's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. about big mind. Big mind is that which includes, little mind is that which excludes. And Buddhism is big-minded in terms of what it's tolerant and it's seeking and you know it rests squarely upon on some precepts that are not unlike Christian the spirit of the New Testament. You know, and it's a directive for living one's life. And then I began to read Taoism and Sufism, and I came to Lao Tzu's wonderful writings, Taoist writings. And there's a poem from Lao Tzu I'd like to read that probably sums up what drew me to all this ancient wisdom, which is at the same time very, very contemporary. And this comes from the Tao Te Ching, the power and the way. I have just three things to teach: simplicity, patience, compassion. These three are your greatest treasures. Simple in actions and in thoughts, you return to the source of being. Patient with both friends and enemies, you accord with the way things are. Compassionate toward yourself, you reconcile all beings in the world. Thus the wise man residing in the Tao sets an example for all beings. Because he doesn't display himself, people can see his light. Because he has nothing to prove, people can trust his words. Because he doesn't know who he is, people recognize themselves in him. Because he has no goal in mind, everything he does succeeds. So I think of those three treasures, simplicity, patience, and compassion, and they are three jewels, and I don't know what more you would need to live a life a sect of Korean Zen Buddhism, I believe it is, that is called the not knowing or don't know sect of Zen. I mean, they begin with that, and I think that's quite wonderful. And William Stafford, in this book, Every War Has Two Losers, and I would ask everyone to think hard about that. And the best wars are the ones we haven't had. You know, Stafford says that we're all on equal ground in what we don't know, that we're all ignorant, and you can rest assured that there's so much that we don't know. Most of it's unknown. If you think you're right and that you know, that's it. I mean, there's no further place to go. There's no evolution. There's nowhere to go. And obviously, then, I mean, you're cut off from the wellsprings that you need, and you're also cut off from other people. And the Tao Te Ching says at some point that he who thinks he knows not. When we talk about knowing, the knowing that one is after is the knowing that is after that person. It's that notion that comes from Rilke's wonderful phrase. Rainer Marie Rilke, the wonderful poet, says that may we be grasped by that which we cannot grasp. And we assume that in some deep, implicit way, the seeker is being sought. But the understanding, and here again is the Greek word for it, is gnosis, which is an understanding not of so much of the head, but of the heart and of the whole person, that deep kind of knowing that's what the body and mind and heart, all of that knows. And Yeah, because he doesn't know who he is, people recognize themselves in him. And Andre Gide says, you know, the worst thing to be is to be right. I'd rather be wrong and learn, you know.
How does poetry and spirit meet?
You know, I consider poetry a vehicle of spirit. And Robert Bly has a wonderful way of putting it. He says that poems are baskets of spirit, that a poem is a form that holds a certain content, and the content is of a spiritual nature. And I think of poems as part of the part of the transmission. And when Bodhidharma came to China, Bodhidharma, the father of Zen Buddhism, came from the West, India, to China in 520 A.D. He brought one message, and it is this. He said famous words. He brought a special transmission outside the scriptures, no dependence upon words and letters, direct pointing at the soul of man, seeing into one's nature and the attainment of Buddhahood. A special transmission outside the scriptures, no dependence upon words and letters. And of course, you and I now we're talking in words and letters because that's what we have. You know, Bodhidharma and the Buddhist understanding would recognize that something else goes on, that there's some kind of other exchange that's outside the words. And I think we're back to the idea of touching here.
Yeah.
You know, where we began. That the only way to the only cure for loneliness is touching, and it's not just the hand on the wrist. It's the touching with voice. I mean, literally, what I'm doing now and what you're doing, I mean, our voices touch one another. They touch the tympanum. They touch that little drum, that little skin drum in the ear, and vibrate. So it's a touching. So speaking is a form of touching, you know, arguably, and it's part of the transmission. And, you know, I mean, all of this, what I've talked about, I mean, it's not mine. You know, I have no claim to it. I'm just part of that transmission. I'm just part of the kind of conduit for the teachings going on beyond me. You know, just that, I think.
Yeah, so.
I want to say one more thing. I was talking with a friend today. He quoted Meister Eckhart, the great German mystic, to me, and he said these words: "If the only prayer we say in our lives is thank you, that will suffice." And there's something wonderfully simple about it, you know.
It's self-contained, but says it all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The thank you is a kind of prayer. That's so when we thank one another, we encourage the cultivation of gratitude, which is something the soul needs. So thank you is a kind of prayer. And I would say, I would offer you the prayer of thank you.